Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Antioch University, New England, helping students change the world with graduate degrees in environmental studies, psychology, education, and management. antioch.edu/new-england.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. These days, there's a lot of attention to the role of money in politics, but when our guest began reporting on this topic more than 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. In fact, NPR's Peter Overby says when he first began as the network's money and politics correspondent back in 1994, some questioned whether this topic had enough substance to create a whole new reporting beat. Since then, it's become clear there's more than enough. The rise of PACs and super PACs, the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, the development of so-called dark money, and Overby's recent focus on the Constitution's Emoluments Clause concerning foreign financial involvement with American elected officials. Peter Overby covered these topics last night in Concord as part of NHPR's Justice and Journalism series, a partnership with UNH Law, and he joins us this morning. You can join us, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. And Peter, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, let's go back to the early 90s. You came to NPR as the new money and politics guy, a newly created beat. And at the time, Peter, you told us last night, some people said, do we really need a whole reporter to look at that? Why do you think people felt that way?
Well, there were only a few reporters really focused on the issue back then. Some of them were at major newspapers, and some of them were at places like Common Cause magazine, which is where I came from. That's where I learned how campaign finance law works. And none of the data was online then. You couldn't pull it off the internet. It took a lot of work to pull the numbers together. You had to go to the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, and print the stuff out there, take it back to the office, and make a spreadsheet of it, and things like that. And it was labor intensive, and at that point, it was just starting to take hold that money was starting to really change the way American politics works.
Well, and it's almost funny to think about it now because everybody talks about money in politics and this group and that group. And we see big outside interest groups spending money on, you know, dinky little races here in New Hampshire. When did you really see this issue taking off, Peter? When did it start to appear on the average person's radar?
I think in the mid-90s, the rise of soft money, which, as I always used in the phrase I used in all the stories I did, soft money is the unregulated contributions coming from corporations, unions, and the wealthy to party committees. And there had been a period where the post-Watergate reforms had really taken hold. Presidential campaigns depended heavily on public financing.
It seems a quaint notion now, public financing.
Archaic.
When was the last time a presidential candidate used that? 8 years ago?
2008, yeah.
Okay.
The contribution limits were low. The money was really tamped down. And money doing what money does was pushing to find new avenues. Soft money turned out to be that avenue. You know, the contributions were unregulated. And they were going to the party committees, which could spend the money on behalf of the candidates. So that came to full blossom in the 96 presidential race.
Well, I actually want to play a clip that we pulled out this morning. This is Senator Arlen Specter reading a letter from two money and politics concerned groups, Democracy 21 and Common Cause. And as you said, you worked for Common Cause. This is at the opening of a big, big Senate subcommittee hearing on soft money spending in the upcoming 2000 election. And you'll hear Senator Specter also reference the 1996 election. So let's just hear.
In response to your recent inquiry, we are writing to confirm that Common Cause and Democracy 21 will shortly ask the Justice Department to conduct an investigation of the illegal use of soft money in the 2000 presidential campaigns by both major party candidates and their political parties. These soft money funds are being used by the presidential campaigns to run ads promoting the Gore and Bush candidacies in the guise of being so-called political party, quote, issue ads, unquote. In fact, the ads are clearly campaign ads to promote the presidential candidates are created by members of the respective presidential campaigns, are targeted to run in key presidential battleground states, and are without question for the purpose of influencing the presidential campaign. As such, it is illegal to fund these ads with soft money. If this practice, which has just begun for the 2000 presidential election, is not stopped, massive violations of the federal campaign finance laws will occur this year in amounts even greater than the similarly massive violations that occurred in the Clinton and Dole 1996 presidential campaigns.
Again, that's former Republican Senator Arlen Specter. And you hear him there, Peter, sounding concerned about what he calls massive violations of campaign finance law. So go ahead.
Okay. So, excuse me, in the 96 campaign, the Democrats had a massive effort to raise soft money, which led to the scandal that I expect we'll end up talking about in a few minutes. But the money went into a huge TV effort that basically kneecapped Bob Dole just as he was coming out of the Republican primaries. There was a barrage of ads presenting Bill Clinton as the president who stood up to Dole Gingrich, one word, Bob Dole, who was then Senate Majority Leader, and Newt Gingrich, who was then Speaker of the House. So they, you know, they tied Dole to Gingrich fanatically.
Well, we see that all the time now. We see, you know, Democrats tying Republican candidates to President Trump in areas of the country where the president is less popular. We see Democrats all the time tied to Pelosi.
Right.
Nancy Pelosi.
The difference is that this was these ads were being paid for with money that, according to the literal reading of the campaign finance law, money was supposed to be used for party building.
Party building, sort of get out the vote, mom and pop, you know, registering people, feel good stuff, not nasty ads that make people look suspicious.
Yeah, and that barrier went down really quickly once the parties started pushing on it.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, I remember all that controversy about soft money, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and that clip raises it again. Now, though, Peter, there really isn't that much going on with soft money, right? All the money is now in these sort of corporate and so-called social welfare groups.
Yeah. Soft money, as we knew it, was outlawed by the McCain-Feingold law, which passed in 2002. And the big action now is with super PACs where the donors are disclosed and 501c4 social welfare organizations where they are not disclosed. And these are groups operating more or less independently of the candidates that they're supporting.
Whereas before with soft money, at least there was some coordination with the party.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
the candidates had some control over the message. Now, some of these groups kind of go off the rails, and we've heard candidates say, that's not me. You know, they sound like they're supporting me, but it's not me.
Right. It adds some excitement to it. But it's also true that, for instance, in the 2012 election, a super PAC and a 501c4 were coordinating between themselves on TV ad buying to promote Mitt Romney at a point when Mitt Romney's campaign was really low on cash. So these two outside groups kept Romney on TV when his campaign couldn't do it.
So that was helpful to him, even though he wasn't allowed to directly control the message.
Right. The message, you know, they came up with a message that sufficed to you know, keep his presence on the air.
Got a couple emails, Peter, that have already come in. The email address for you to join us as we talk about money and politics, campaign finance, lobbying, influence. That's the beat of our guest, Peter Overby. The email address, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Going back to that clip we heard from Senator Arlen Specter, talking about the 1996 election, talking about the upcoming, at that time, 2000 election. Last night at our event at UNH Law, Peter, you said that the Clinton White House had its own money and politics headlines. What was happening?
Well, they were raising the soft money that paid for the Dahl Gingrich ads. The strategy to get Bill Clinton elected depended on this big influx of soft money. A lot of the money came from people that hadn't been active in American politics before. There were a lot of donors who seemed to have ties to China and Indonesia, and a lot of money that when they tried to account for where it came from, it was hard to explain. It's a complicated story, but the gist of it is that the DNC had this huge hunger for cash, and they had people going out and finding it wherever they could, and it got them in deep trouble.
Somebody made a subway analogy, right, about
right.
The Clinton White House.
Yeah,
what was that?
Yeah, Johnny Chung, he was one of the donor fundraiser folks, and he was testifying before a House committee, and this is a close paraphrase. He said the White House is like a subway. You have to put money in to go through the turnstile.
Kind of chilling. And
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. And yeah, so that was 19. He said that in 1997 or 98. And then at the beginning of this week, Congressman Chris Collins, he's from upstate New York, was talking about the tax reform bill and how the House Republicans had to deliver on it. And he said, my donors are basically saying, get it done or don't ever call me again. So, you know, that there's an evolution of the message here from being blatant talking about it to being blatant talking about the pressure that you're under to deliver.
So openly saying that money talks?
Yeah, yeah. And there have been stories over the past couple months about big Republican donors being angry at the Republicans in Congress for not delivering.
For not delivering on health care tax reform so far, although that's still underway.
Yeah, and with this threat of, you know, if things don't get better, we're going to cut you off.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Well, talking about a quid pro quo, here's a clip from President Trump when he was still running for the presidency during the Republican primary. Here he is during the first Republican debate in August of 2015, talking about how he sees the role of big money in politics. Let's hear.
I will tell you that our system is broken. I give to many people. Before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them, 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me.
So there's the president kind of saying, of course it matters. And as a businessman, I was very happy that it mattered.
He's talking about access, which is the the basic thing that the money gets a donor. You know, if you give money, you'll get your call returned. That's the minimum. And, you know, whether it gets something more explicit than that, then you start getting into territory that that lawyers get interested in. But, and the evolution of that that statement, money gets you access, has evolved. That it used to be, oh, well, money only gets you access. And then it's like people, you know, thought twice about it. Money gets you access? So it's become a more controversial statement than it was some years ago.
Well, when you talk to politicians about this, and, you know, I've asked them about this over the years, they say money doesn't change the way that I vote. You know, people give to me because we're on the same page politically. You know, if I'm on the Agriculture Committee and I'm a farmer myself, then of course agriculture interests are going to give to me. It just makes sense. So they say it's not a matter of someone giving me cash and me voting their way. We're already in the same boat, so to speak.
Yeah, which is
often, that true?
It's often true, yeah. There are also cases where you get down to an issue. Within that broad issue, there are very specific issues that benefit, you know, one agricultural sector over another or one company over another. And that, you know, those specifics are more important in this discussion than the broad generality about supporting agriculture.
The phone number again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Our guest today is Peter Overby. He covers power, money, and influence for National Public Radio. For two decades, he's looked at lobbying, campaign finance, and recently what's known as the Emoluments Clause. That's language in our Constitution that tries to keep foreign money from influencing our government. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. You can join us as well. The number, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Carla in Manchester. She says, one suggestion for more transparency, like in car racing, all members of Congress should wear their corporate sponsors' logos on their clothes. And we've got a big NASCAR race here in New Hampshire, so people are familiar with the bright colors of all the ads that the drivers have. But Carla raises an important point. You know, a lot of people have said, Peter, that it's not the amount of cash that matters, it's disclosure. Just tell me who's giving to Peter Overby for Congress. I don't care how much you're giving, but just tell me who it is. So just sort of untangle that for us, please.
Okay, well, transparency is generally thought of as a good thing. There are arguments made against it, but, you know, the general consensus is transparency is good. The hard part comes because there are so many venues for donors, aside from making small regulated contributions to the candidate. You know, you could max out to the candidate. You could give to the party committee to support the candidate. You could give to a super PAC. You could give to a 501c4 social welfare organization that could run ads supporting the candidate or attacking the candidate's opponent. And all of those contributions would be much higher than what you gave to the candidate.
I see. So in other words, at each level, your contribution to Peter Overby for Congress may not look that big. But once you start looking at all the different opportunities to give in different forms and fashions, it adds up to a lot of money.
Yeah. And to go off on a short tangent about this, in New Jersey, one of the U.S. senators is on trial right now for bribery.
Right.
Robert Menendez. One of the charges is that the his friend who was doing all these favors that are alleged to be bribes. One thing he did was he made a contribution to a super PAC and earmarked it for New Jersey. And the prosecutors say that is a bribe.
I see. You're not supposed to be that specific with it.
Right.
All right. And Peter, okay. I got to jump in on you. We will follow up after a short break. I also want to ask you about 501c4s and the rise of so-called dark money, because we've seen that play a role here in New Hampshire elections. All that's coming up, plus your questions and comments, so stay with us.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Peter Overby is with us, NPR correspondent who covers money in politics. Peter is visiting New Hampshire as part of our Justice and Journalism series in partnership with UNH Law School in Concord. The number for you to join us now with your questions and comments about just how our system of money in politics has evolved, 1-800-892-6477. If you have questions about dark money, soft money, what contributions really mean, what the Emoluments Clause is, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Peter, just before the break, you were talking about the recent New Jersey race or the New Jersey case with Menendez. And it raises the bigger question, is a campaign contribution a bribe?
I think the law has gone both ways on this. But in this case, it's not even a contribution to Menendez's campaign. It's a contribution to a super PAC, which is supposedly independent of Menendez. So, you know, if that's deemed a bribe, then that changes the landscape in campaign finance somewhat.
Well, this gets into this, you know, area that's real interesting. So let's go in. These groups that are supposedly independent of the campaign, but everybody kind of rolls their eyes because, you know, they're all basically reading from the same, singing from the same hymnal, if I could put it that way. Are these the 501c4s, Peter? Is that what these groups are?
Yeah.
With funny names like, you know, Americans for Mom and Apple Pie.
Yeah. Social welfare groups.
But not your local soup kitchen. That's not
right,
what we're talking about. It
right.
Sounds like it.
Well, the soup kitchen might be a charity, a 501c3. But a lot of civic organizations are c4s. And it's like this category of tax-exempt organization was sitting there, and all of a sudden politics moved in. So I don't know what effect it has on the groups that, you know, were already there. I don't think it affects them that much, actually. But it has changed the way people think about and the way the government thinks about 501c4 category.
So who are some of the most famous 501c4s, Peter?
Americans for Prosperity.
That's the Koch brothers.
Right. And the Democrats have, Priorities USA Action.
Sure. Well, all the names sound the same, so you're to be forgiven for not remembering the exact words.
Yeah, there are a lot of them out there. I did a story a few years ago on a thing called the Wellspring Committee, which is a 501c4 that aggregates money and gives it to other 501c4s, which is a different way that the c4 world operates.
And these are really hard to track. I mean, it's one thing if you see an ad that says paid for by the Republican National Committee, paid for by Mitt Romney for president. But these names and just the money trail is extremely complicated to follow.
A C4 doesn't have to disclose its donors. It does have to disclose organizations that it makes grants to. So, like the Center for Responsive Politics has worked that to build trees of money flowing from one C4 to another to another.
You know, we have seen a lot of this dark money or 501c4 money here in New Hampshire's elections, sometimes in, you know, Senate races, state Senate races, which you think, why does this giant national group care about New Hampshire's state Senate? What have you seen, Peter, in terms of these large national organizations playing a role in even smaller races?
There's a lot of interest in Washington in shaping the outcomes of down ballot elections. You know, like the Republicans had this this redistricting program where they tried to shape districts to support Republican candidates in a lot of states. And the first step in that is winning control of the state legislatures. And
because whoever wins control during the census year gets to redraw the map, and everybody draws it to favor their side.
Exactly. So Republicans and conservatives more broadly have been working on this for many years, and you can see the results if you look at a map of how many states are controlled by Republicans and how many controlled by Democrats.
So that's why all the activity, even at the small state Senate level.
Yeah. It's
even state house sometimes.
Yeah, it's long range planning by political strategists in Washington.
You know, in our last elections here in New Hampshire, we saw a lot of outside money, And one of our producers, Jessica Hunt, put together a couple of the ads that we heard from these groups. And I think people will go, oh, yeah, that's classic. You know, the dark, scary music and the crazy charges that sometimes these ads make. So here's a couple clips from some of these scary ads that these groups aired in last year's U.S. Senate race here in New Hampshire between then Governor Maggie Hassan and then U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte. By the way, by September of last year, so 2 months before the election, Peter, outside groups had already spent $50 million just on this. And we're a small state. Let's just hear a little bit of that advertising because it gives us a flavor of how these groups operate.
Ayotte claims she's independent, then goes to Washington and votes with the Koch brothers 90% of the time.
And Hassan won't even rule out bringing terrorist prisoners to the U.S.
New Hampshire women need to know that Kelly Ayotte opposes a woman's right to choose.
A former Exeter teacher committed sexual misconduct.
So anyway, you get the idea. And I'm guessing that all around the country, the same ads play, but they just put in a different name.
Well, usually the groups try to tailor it to the race, like you won't find the Exeter teacher or anything resembling that in every state. So, a lot of effort goes into these ads. The research, the ad strategies. It's not like they're just tossing them off. These are really sophisticated operations.
How do you think these ads that we've seen so much of in the past decade, Peter, how do you think they've sort of changed the way Americans feel about their elections, about their whole democratic process?
Well, I expect it's not positive. the ads just sort of wash over you by now because there are so many of them. I live in Virginia, and Virginia did not used to be a battleground state. Now it is, and the D.C. ad market is radically changed because of that.
You know, speaking of that money that was spent in that Hassan Ayotte race, here's an email from Brian in Antrim who says, just a reminder, big money in politics is not just a Washington issue. Brian says, in the Maggie Hassan Kelly Ayotte U.S. Senate race, over $100 million was spent, most of it from out-of-state donors to super PACs. Brian says, outside donors have played a huge part in both of our recent Senate races. He says, it's the golden rule of politics. He who has the gold makes the rules. And our system sets candidates up to have to do favors to get elected. Brian says it's time for citizen-funded elections. Brian, thank you so much. And let's talk about that. Citizen-funded elections. What does that really mean? There's a couple different forms that it's taken.
Yeah, the one that I'm most familiar with is a voucher system. They have this in Seattle, and it's Seattle was one of the pioneers in it. Voters in Seattle get vouchers that are worth a certain amount of money. I think it's like $20, but I'm not sure. And they can give those vouchers to candidates in the election.
What about businesses or big organizations? Can they also give?
They don't get vouchers, no.
They don't get vouchers, but they could give their own money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
sure.
I don't believe it prevents the candidate from taking other money, but the vouchers are to give ordinary people a voice.
So it's like public financing.
Without the bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. Public financing, and people get to give, though, to whichever candidate they want.
Right. And it's, you know, it's the voters making the decision. It's not, as in public financing, the candidates trying to meet a standard of small donor support.
Yeah. Well, and that gets to what we talked about last night at UNH Law, the public financing of presidential campaigns. And it used to be standard practice, right, Peter, for presidential candidates to raise a certain amount on their own and then take the public financing. But people haven't done that in a long time.
Yeah, the public financing system never was able to keep up with the growth in campaign budgets. And by now, it would be, you know, to bring it up to date would be just enormously expensive. And there are a lot of people who think it's a terrible idea anyway. So
why do people think it's a terrible idea? Brian says it's time for public financing of campaigns. Citizen-funded elections, he says.
Well, there are several reasons. One is just sort of philosophical. Taxpayers shouldn't be paying for you know, for candidates they didn't choose. And there's also the notion that people qualify as candidates just to get the money and then stop running.
Oh, my goodness.
Which does not happen at the federal level so much. But, you know, at the local level, I think sometimes that has happened. So
that Seattle experiment that you talked about gets around the issue of, I don't want my tax dollars going to, you know, these candidates. I don't like them. In Seattle, you can choose who to give your public dollars to.
Yeah.
Do you think the presidential system of, you know, the public match, the public financing in our presidential system is just gone at this point? Hasn't been used for the last two cycles. All the candidates have said, yeah, it's really nice, but it's not enough.
They don't even say that anymore. It's a non-issue.
Yeah, it's a non-issue. I remember, you know, not that long ago where it was kind of an issue. Will he or she take the money or won't they? You know, it was kind of the big question.
Yeah. And then there's a period where if you didn't take the money, it's like the cork popped on the, you know, on the bottle and this money just came flooding toward you because you didn't have the contribution or the overall limits on what you can fundraise.
Well, Brian, thank you again for the email. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. You can give us a call too, 1-800-892-6477. Peter Overby is here. He covers money and politics for NPR, and we'd love to answer your questions, take your comments about just how this system works, how it's evolved. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You know, Peter, at our event with UNH Law last night, somebody asked us this question, and I want to put it out there again. In her book, Dark Money, Jane Mayer quotes Charles Koch's referencing, quote, weaponized philanthropy. And this person asked, could you comment on the role of nonprofits, nonprofits and money in politics? You already sort of talked about these 501c4s, these social welfare, in quotes, groups. But what does that mean, weaponized philanthropy?
There's not a big difference between, on the donor side, it's not a big difference between a 501c4 and a 501c3. You know, they're both kind of, you know, do-good kinds of organizations to give money to. So when it's weaponized, he's talking about turning it into a political weapon, as C4s have become. And one question is whether 501c3s, the charity world, is going to start getting politicized as well.
Can you talk about that? Because somebody asked about that last night as well. They said in the current tax reform debate on Capitol Hill, is money in politics coming up at all in that debate?
Yeah, the one place where that I know of where it's coming up is a provision that would repeal the ban on churches getting involved in partisan politics. And, you know, if churches are allowed to do that, then will the other C3s be far behind?
Who are some of the other C3s? Just give us an example. Because for your average person, it's like C3, C4. I don't really understand the difference.
It's your average charity. You know, the local charity that, you know, like the food bank, for instance, I think would be a C3.
Tax-exempt charity, yeah. Doing good work in the community.
Yeah, and the difference on the donor side, the difference between a C3 and a C4 is that a C3, the contribution that the donor makes is tax deductible. And with a C4, it's not.
So if C3s were allowed to get involved in politics, that would mean what, Peter? What's the issue there?
One way to phrase it would be that taxpayers would be subsidizing the contributions because the contributions would be tax deductible.
And people don't like that idea.
Presumably.
The phone number again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from James in Hudson. What is your take on the recent news about Commerce Secretary Ross's ownership of a shipping company co-owned by Putin insiders? Is this significant or just a distraction? James, thank you for the email. And this gets us into a whole new area, Peter, that you have recently started covering, and that is the emoluments clause.
Yes,
go ahead. Do you want to answer James's question directly, and then we'll talk about emoluments?
Well, when Ross was nominated and being vetted for the secretary's job, he had a lot of financial holdings, and the way it works is the nominee works with the Office of Government Ethics to clean things up, to eliminate conflicts of interest, and usually the way you do that is to divest. You sell off the things that would cause conflicts, and Ross did a lot of that. He sold off most of what he had, but he held on to a few things, and one of them was the shipping company. And at the time, it attracted some notice. I'm talking about last winter when the administration was setting up. And, you know, people noticed that this is one thing that he held on to. And the connection to Russia was not known then. And there's, I think, probably more to know about it than we do now. But, you know, it still doesn't exactly explain why he held on to it.
So has anybody asked him why you hold on to this thing? You did a decent job divesting yourself of all this other stuff?
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, that's okay. And this does get us into a newer area that you've been covering, Peter, and that is emoluments. And I have to say, up until probably 6 months ago, I'd never heard that word before. It's kind of an old-fashioned colonial word. What does emolument mean?
Well, specifically what it means is a matter of legal debate right now because there are three lawsuits about it against Trump. There are two emolument clauses in the Constitution, foreign and domestic. And the foreign one, which is kind of the first one to come before the courts, the clause says that a federal official cannot take any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from a foreign government or foreign official without the consent of Congress.
So it's basically an effort by those framers to keep foreign money from influencing our government.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. And you've been doing a lot of work on that. And I'll ask you about that after a break. And we'll keep taking your calls, emails, the number 1-800-892-6477. James, thanks for that email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Peter Overby is here. For more than 20 years, Overby has covered money in politics for NPR. His official title is correspondent on power, money, and influence. That's the beat. that Peter Overby has covered for more than two decades, examining lobbying, campaign finance, and recently what's known as the Emoluments Clause. That's language in our Constitution that tries to keep foreign money from influencing our government. You can join our conversation at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, Peter, just before the break, we were talking about what emoluments are, why we're hearing so much about the Emoluments Clause, the coverage you're doing. Just to sort of explain this a little bit more for folks, I want to play a clip from Noah Bookbinder. He's executive director of a group called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics. They filed a suit against President Trump for not separating his private business interests from his presidential responsibilities based on this emoluments clause. Let's just hear a little bit from Noah Bookbinder.
It's the first time that a court is going to be hearing arguments about the emoluments clause, what an emolument is, what the president actually is prohibited from doing under the Constitution. Business records for the Trump companies and other relevant documents, potentially including tax returns, that'll tell us what foreign government payments and what state government payments the president's companies may be receiving in violation of the Constitution.
So again, that's Noah Bookbinder, and his group has filed a lawsuit against the administration saying that the president hasn't done a good enough job separating his private business interests from, again, his responsibilities in the Oval Office. I'm struck by what he says, that this is the first time that the court has looked at the Emoluments Clause. It's been around for a long time.
Yeah, and there is a lot of subjudicial administrative law about emoluments, because when generals retire from the military, they're not considered fully retired. The federal law still applies to them in some ways, including the Emoluments Clause. So, retired Air Force general gets a consulting contract with a foreign company or a foreign government. That's considered an emolument, and it gets reviewed.
So lots of this debate goes on, but not at the higher court levels.
Yeah, and partly because this is the way the debate has been done, the definition of emolument has gotten more and more specific over the years. So one thing that I came across in covering this, there's a law professor who tracked down the 40 dictionaries, English language dictionaries, that were in print and available at the time the Constitution was drafted. They're all online. I had no idea about any of this, but he did.
That's kind of cool, actually, that he went back and looked at that.
Yeah, and that he could do it, over the internet.
Right.
So the question is, what is an emolument? And the Justice Department is defending President Trump in his role as president, which is the way he got sued on this thing. And they started out with a definition that an emolument is profit arising from office or employ. And they cited one dictionary there. So that's one of the 40. 37 of the 40, according to the law professor, define emolument more broadly. They don't connect it to holding office, or specifically the office that you are in. They define it, the most common words were profit, gain, advantage, or benefit, which is a much broader definition, and if the court buys it, would be much more troubling for President Trump's arguments.
No, you're a campaign finance guy. You're not a historian, right, of the American Revolution or the Constitution. But why do you think that the founders specifically put that language in there?
Emolument was a much more common word then, it turns out. One other thing the law professor came up with, and he showed this to me. There's a place on Google where you couldn't tell you where it is because I can't remember, but a place on Google where you can plug a word in and it will give you a graph of its usage over time. And so for emolument, the usage peaked in the 1600s or early 1700s, and then started a gradual downward curve came up again a little bit around the time of the Constitution and then went down again, and by the mid-1800s was kind of flatlined going across until you get to 2016, 2017. There's this little tip up at the end.
So do you think the framers put it in there because they were worried about foreign kings and princes? I think there's some language around that,
exactly.
Giving extravagant gifts to elected officials,
exactly.
and that swaying how those elected officials approached those foreign governments.
Right. They
That was their concern.
Yeah. The two emoluments clauses, foreign and domestic, they were concerned about foreign countries meddling in the American government, and they were concerned about states trying to influence the national government.
States meaning
the new states, you know, the Massachusetts, Virginia, Pennsylvania,
sure.
et cetera.
Let's take a call, Peter. And Tim is in Portsmouth. Hi, Tim. You're on the air with Peter Overby. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a question for the guest, and it's a good closing question. And basically, I'd like to know his opinion on whether or not he thinks, considering the current state of money in politics, it may be too late, whether or not it's too late to recover a true representative form of democracy. I don't believe we have that right now. We the vast majority of us are not represented at all because we can't afford to purchase the politicians. So I'm interested in his opinion on whether or not it's too late.
Too late to sort of pull back the role of money in politics? Is that what you're saying, Tim?
Yeah, recover a representative form of democracy. Basically, our elected representatives, we're lucky in our state. They do represent us. But you look at the polls and then look at how the representatives vote and do their job, and there's a giant disconnect between what the majority of the population wants and believes in and what they do. And basically it's tied to the fact that vested interest with money have purchased these politicians. You talked about it earlier, and we the B word came up, bribe, but it's obvious to the vast majority of our population that our politicians don't represent us anymore. They
represent
people.
Well, Tim, thanks for the call. And, you know, this came up. I'm glad you called because this did come up last night at our event with UNH Law. The idea that for those who feel the way Tim does, and not everybody does, but for those who feel the way Tim does, the question is how much would attempts to rein in the role of money be effective? I mean, just listening to you talk for this past hour, Peter, it seems like there are reforms, there are regulations, somebody finds a way around it, kind of a game of whack-a-mole. When the rules say you can't do this, then these groups say, okay, fine, we'll do that. So I wonder, Tim, it's a great question.
Yeah, I mean, the history of American government generally is, you know, has that sort of whack-a-mole feel to it, that, you know, the problem arises, it's dealt with, another problem arises. In money and politics world, it's called the hydraulic effect, where money bubbles up one place, regulations come along or a law comes along, pushes it down.
Like McCain-Feingold.
For instance, yeah, excellent example. And money bubbles up another place. So
you squeeze the balloon and, you know, you're able to squeeze that area, but then it just goes somewhere else.
Yeah, and so then you have a question, well, does that make the whole thing a fool's errand? And it's also worth considering, if it is a hydraulic effect, how long does the fix last? How long are things improved before the next problem comes along?
Improved, again, in the minds of those who feel like
right.
money has too much
exactly. yeah.
play in our political system. So Tim's question, is it too late? Is it a fool's errand, as you say?
Probably not. I mean, people are always going to be fighting over this.
And there's so much money, and those with it want to spend it.
Yeah, yeah. The stakes are high.
And we have a First Amendment,
mm-hmm.
which says that money can be equated with political speech.
Right. And, you know, how the rules are shaped helps determine who's going to win. And both sides want to win. So, you know, the fight will continue.
Well, Tim, thank you for the question. Here's one from Kathy in Concord. Your guest said that political ads tend to wash over the public. Is he intimating that they have no effect? If so, I would disagree strongly. Kathy says the negative ads, angry ads, derisive nature of some of them, and those that are mostly untrue do not wash over the public, but rather create an atmosphere of negativity and degradation that permeates our society and distance us from grassroots democracy. Kathy, thank you for the email. I think, Peter, when you said they wash over you, I don't think you were saying they don't have an effect, but right. There's just so many.
Right. But the other point is that partly because of all the negative ads, you know, there is less interest, you know, less voter interest in getting involved.
So they depress turnout because people just say, oh, it's so ugly, I don't want to even get in the mud pile.
Right. So then you're trying to reach, you know, your core supporters and discourage the other side's core supporters.
So Kathy's right. It creates negativity.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Negativity depresses, hopefully, the other side's turnout. That's the hope that these groups have.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the ad campaigns now are operating on those principles.
Kathy, thank you for the email. Here's one from Logan in Exeter who says, while I do think some of the money spent on getting elected is wasted, the fact that this money does win elections means that it will keep being spent. Logan says shifting from private to publicly funded elections doesn't solve the root issue, which is that a portion of our voters are uneducated on the issues, Logan says, vote strictly by party and or relying on sound bites to decide their vote. Thank you, Logan, for that one. Here's one from Terry in Campton who says, I was at the program in Concord last night. Again, that was at UNH Law, and did not think to ask this until driving home. Terry says, has Peter ever felt threatened by anyone or any group as a result of his investigation into following the money or influence on our election processes? Terry, thank you for the question. Peter?
No, I haven't.
Well, that's reassuring.
Yeah.
And here's one from Linda who says, just want to thank Peter Overby for his reporting on money in our politics. Linda says, amazing research, explanation, details, and dot connecting. So important and so undercovered and glossed over. Linda, thank you for your appreciation. And speaking of money and politics and how NPR covers it now, Peter, and including, you know, all the possible conflicts of interest in the Trump administration, given the business interests all around the world, there's a couple people looking at this now. It's not just you.
Oh, yeah. The major newspapers have several people working different aspects of this beat. And at NPR, we've farmed out parts of it in an ad hoc sort of way. One of the factors is that the Trump business stuff kind of comes on top of that, and so there's more to deal with. You know, it's the
no. Hang on. What's the difference between emoluments and what you call the Trump business stuff?
Oh, the emoluments, conflicts of interest. Emoluments is part of the larger issue. I'm on the NPR Trump conflict of interest team, so you know I come at it from the Washington desk. We have another reporter from the international desk, another one from the business desk.
So emoluments are foreign business interests or moneyed interests in American politics. What you generally call President Trump conflict of interest or business interests is more just the business stuff here domestically? Is that the separation?
Or his business interests overseas. There's an argument that when he has a hotel overseas, any decision that country's government makes that benefits the hotel benefits his bottom line. So none of these cases have there aren't legal cases about, but none of these examples have really proven to be especially interesting yet. But it's something that I think everybody who covers this stuff is on the alert for.
On the alert for in terms of business interests influencing the way that the administration
yes.
makes decisions.
Yes. Yeah, and there's a legal brief that I was reading the other day in one of the other emolument suits, where the argument was the United States has a system of diplomacy through which discussions are conducted that have to do with national security. And, you know, this stuff is recorded, it's documented, and, you know, there are records of it. The argument that was being made was that foreign officials can deal through, can reach out to Trump through his businesses, and then you have a back channel where they can conduct the same conversations, but it's all off the books.
Off the books because it's business.
It's private. It's a non-governmental conversation. You know, it's not going through government channels, so there's no documentation. There are no formal procedures for it.
Last question for you, Peter, and it's kind of a big one, so I apologize for throwing it to you at the end. How does all your work looking at conflicts of interest, emoluments clause, and so forth, how does that tie into Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation?
Don't know that it does yet.
Yet being the operative word.
Yeah. You know, who knows where his investigation is going? You know, so far, you know, all he's got is indictments and a plea deal for some people, you know, outside the White House. The question, you know, as he gets closer, as he's trying to do to Russia, then you have questions about how Russia business deals would affect or be affected by the official relationship.
And that's where your team's work comes in. Okay.
It would, yeah.
And when you say he, you mean Robert Mueller.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Peter, we've got to wrap it up there. Okay. There's a lot more we could have talked about.
Yes.
Thank you for coming in. I'm glad we had some good weather for you while you were here in New Hampshire.
Thank you very much.
That's NPR's Peter Overby. Again, for more than 20 years, he's covered money and politics for National Public Radio. He's in New Hampshire this week for our Justice and Journalism event in partnership with the Redmond Center at UNH Law. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.